Welcome to What the Kids Were Watching, a podcast dedicated to the weird, wonderful, and terrible babysitter movies of our youth. We will be exploring the movies that we grew up with, that we watched repeatedly, whether they deserved it or not. We'll be talking about whether those movies hold up years later, what parts of them we think are salvageable, what parts of them we still adore, and what parts of them need to go in the recycling bin. My name is Sada, and my co-host is Raphael. Hello, Raph.
Hello, Sada. Full disclosure to you folks. First of all, we are a happily married couple who loves watching way too many movies on the couch that we are recording from. And two, we will spoil the entire movie we are discussing.
Yes. So if you have not seen Real Genius, which is today's topic, and you want to see it, stop the podcast, find a copy, watch it. Full disclosure, another disclosure, it is worth your time. I have nothing negative to say about this movie. We are going to talk about it with great love, great affection, and again, there will be spoilers. So be prepared. And we're excited that you're on this tiny little under-the-building subway car with us to talk about Real Genius. Okay, so Real Genius came out in... Ruff, when did this movie come out?
Came out August 2nd, 1985. If you can imagine this, it came out barely a week before Weird Science.
Those movies are always paired together in my head, even though I've never seen Weird Science. It might have been discouraged in my household because of the cover. Also, just so you know, we have my 16-year-old rescue dog on the couch with us. I got her from the Austin Pound 14 years ago. And so she's still going strong, but not as strong as she used to be. So if she wants to sit on the couch and snore next to us, she is going to do that. And that sound is just included free of charge for you. So, Real Genius. I pause because I don't even know where to start because I love this movie so much. But starting with the plot is probably a good place to start. All right. So Real Genius starts off with this meeting between people who are clearly in the defense industry and they're building this terrifying weapon. And then it jumps to a kid's science fair. And we meet Mitch Taylor, who's this dorky, but still kind of relatable. Like, you can tell that his mom dresses him. He's a dorky kid in high school, and he gets visited by Professor Jerry Hathaway. Jerry Hathaway in this movie's universe is like Neil deGrasse Tyson. Everyone knows who he is. People just idolize him. He's got his TV show. And Jerry Hathaway tells Mitch, "You got into Pacific Tech early." Pacific Tech is this college where the best and the brightest and the weirdest go to school, and most of them study very, very hard, but some of them are fantastically fun and party and do crazy things like, turn the hallway into this ice-filled pathway and everybody, you know, ice skates through it and just have all these wonderful pranks and fun. And the person in charge of all the pranks and fun is Chris Knight, who used to be the smartest person at Pacific Tech and then sort of cracked and became the most fun and smartest person at Pacific Tech. So Mitch and Chris work together on this secret project for Hathaway. Turns out it's a weapon. It's a big weapon, and Hathaway is doing some seriously bad things with the money that he's getting for it. Long story short, the kids eventually, aided by their also fantastic friends, figure out it's a weapon and pull this amazing stunt to stop it.
Yeah, that's about as concise as it gets. What I think makes this movie play beyond, if you just hear the surface, you're going, that sounds like a sort of teen comedy slash Spielberg-y movie almost. But what's sort of unique about it, even now, about 34 years later, is that it respects its characters. It's not a sex comedy. Mm-hmm.
There are girls in bikinis and they get chased by the nerdy guys. But Ross's right. It does respect its characters and it doesn't make the mistake of telling you it's funny. It just lets its actors do their things and they each play their roles so well and they all work together so well. It's not like Revenge of the Nerds where there's a stereotypical like leader and dork and effeminate person. Like everybody in this movie feels like they have a personality that could be really real.
And you'll hear me mentioning a bunch of names on the crew on this project who are all incredibly talented people. They're Oscar winners. Every part of the process of making this movie had talented people working on it as opposed to making a quick, cheap movie. And it's also interesting that it's directed by Martha Coolidge, and it's pretty clear that the best teen movies of the early mid-80s were actually all directed by women.
I love that. That's so awesome. So when I think about the movies of my childhood, these babysitter movies that I just watched over and over, either because I loved or because they were there and they were tolerable, Real Genius is always at the top. And for a long time, I thought I was the only person who loved this movie. But oh my God, I loved this movie so much. I loved this movie so much that I went to Harvard University. I am a Harvard alum because I thought Harvard was going to be like Pacific Tech. I was so wrong. Talking about my experience at Harvard could make for like three other podcasts, but suffice it to say, it had more competition and less of that sort of fun, wacky vibe that an 80s comedy had. Who would have possibly guessed?
Years later, when Coolidge took the movie and actually had a screening of it and invited a bunch of scientists from USC and Caltech, which is university it's based on.
Yes, I should have gone to Caltech or MIT. I've heard that also.
In the audience were 12 Nobel Prize winners and a whole slew of these people, the scientists that went and talked to her afterwards, said this movie made them want to get into science.
Oh my God, I love that.
And it's because it, in short, made science sexy and fun, and the idea that it's cool to be smart. And mm-hmm. that, and the movie doesn't treat any character stupid. Every character in the movie, actually, across the board, is intelligent. Mm-hmm. It's how they treat the people around them is how you judge whether they're a good person or not.
Exactly. That's right. In fact, I made this note about Chris Knight, in particular, played by Val Kilmer. My favorite Val Kilmer role ever. I mean, mm-hmm. I know Top Secret is a fun movie, but he's funny and in this wonderful, dry way that he was fantastic to see. As a young woman watching this movie, Chris Knight was fantastic to see in a movie because I both wanted to grow up and date him, but I also wanted to be him, and that was possible. So he's fantastic. And what makes him a great leading character in this movie is that he's compassionate. He's kind. He's nice to Mitch. He's funny to Mitch. He jokes around with him. When Mitch freaks out, he pulls him aside and he makes him feel better. He's a good friend and a good person. In the Pacific Tech universe, they have the nerds that we want to see in the world. They're smart without being arrogant. They're kind and compassionate to each other. And they do the right thing. When they make a mistake or when they realize that this project they're working on is going to be this horrible weapon, they do what it takes to make things better and to take it down, even if that's at a cost to themselves. So I don't want to name names about any famous names in the technology industry who create products that spy on us and sell our data. But, you know, the behavior that you see in the news, complete antithesis of what I loved about and what a lot of people loved about Real Genius. The funny thing was about related to what Roth was saying about these Nobel Prize winners who saw Real Genius and wanted to be scientists. Even though Harvard was not as fun and crazy as Pacific Tech, I met a lot of people I'm still friends with, who also loved this movie. We all wanted to date Chris Knight. Someone I did date even put together a fish tank out of a water cooler. The goldfish didn't last long, but you know, we tried. We tried our best.
There's a wonderful core philosophy. Knight himself says it in the middle of the movie when Mitch has his first breakdown of dealing with college. And he talks about how,
when you're smart, people need you.
You know, it's good to love solving problems, but they're not the answers to everything because you can't live by all science and no philosophy.
Which is why one of Chris's most famous lines that they keep repeating in the movie is, it's a moral imperative. When somebody does something wrong, you get back at them because it's a moral imperative. When the project you've been working on is a giant bomb that's going to destroy people from space, you stop it because it's a moral imperative. Something that we could, you know, we should remind ourselves of right now when we work on stuff.
This was such a breath of fresh air compared to the Porky's and the dozens of projects like joysticks, hard bodies, going for it. Like every movie had some sort of very blunt sexual metaphor in the title.
Mm-hmm.
This was a movie where his expression of sex, and it's clear he's having sex, but what he does is that he tries to open up avenues for people to talk to each other and be with each other. His parties are all really about bringing people together and getting them to have fun. Because there's a point where he gets a bunch of student beauticians together with some scientist kids.
And they turn the auditorium into basically a water slide park. And it's fun. And, you know, yeah, people are sort of getting a little physical with each other. But it's really just about blasting Bryan Adams music and talking. And he even tells the guys, like, you know, these women don't know smart people or a lot of smart people, and they will be impressed by you. He's encouraging. I will say I have a lot of really positive things to say about female representation in this movie. Mm-hmm. The one problem that I do have is that party, because I admit this is totally my bias. I don't like plot lines where nerd boys fall for the hot girl and then try to get her, especially if they have a sort of kind of nerdy girl friend, because nerd girls need love too. You know, I personally am not a fan of the story of, like, you know, the nerd getting the super popular person, unless you can make them interesting characters who connect to each other. I think Stranger Things has done that really well. It sort of had the, like, the cross click interactions that work. But, you know, nerd girls, we needed a real genius. We need more representation out there about how funny and interesting we are, and we shouldn't just be, you know, ignored on the sideline, and not to mention the fact that women shouldn't be seen as prizes for dudes to win.
Well, and that's why I want to bring up the three key women of the movie.
Yes.
Because starting with the least important, you get a side character, like there's the daughter of the general who just pops up in two scenes, a general who is trying to get this laser to work, and he's working with Hathaway, and Chris Knight bumps into her twice. And she is Deborah Foreman, so she was like this upcoming actress. She was in Valley Girl, one of Coolidge's first movies, so it's sort of like a cameo of a friend. And this is a character who's clearly presented as a potential sex symbol character. But what I love is that when Knight starts flirting with her, she's attracted to him, you can tell, but then she immediately comes up with one of the best rejoinders I've ever heard.
Which, I know you want to say it.
She asks,
Can you hammer a 6-inch nail through a board with your penis? And when he says, taken aback, well, no, she says, a girl's got to have her standards. It's such a throwaway line. But again, it like sets her up as somebody who can dish it out as well as she can take it. And I appreciate that.
And then in another supporting role is this older scientist named Sherry, who's tracking down the 10 top scientists in the country. And she's sort of a scientist groupie.
Yeah. And there is a creepy scene where she waits for Mitch in his room and then comes on to him. He's 15. I remain creeped out by that scene. But at the end, heavy spoiler ahead, she ends up with Laszlo Hollifeld, who used to be a Pacific Tech student, kind of lost it when he realized what he was working on was dangerous and has been living in the basement ever since. But he is, in theory, the smartest person in the country. And she finds him and she loves him because he's smart. What a wonderful thing to see. What a wonderful way to be appreciated. That was cool.
And then that's leading up to
my favorite.
And mine too, which is Michelle Merrick as Jordan, who is this incredibly OCD.
Well, she describes herself as hyperkinetic, which I believe is an outdated word for like ADD, ADHD. Basically, she talks fast. Her mind jumps from subject to subject. She throws herself into projects. She knits Mitch a sweater overnight. I knit. I could never do a whole sweater overnight without heavy drugs and focus and probably a knitting machine. Jordan is badass. I love her. I love her because, first of all, this movie is completely devoid of any sort of, like, that's a girl thing. Nobody talks about, nothing is off limits for the girls. Jordan is present at the shenanigans. She's present for their work. She's present for when they have to get back at the villain, one of the villains who we'll talk about in a second. And she's there as part of the crew helping them stop the weapon at the end.
And she's played by an actress that's not very well remembered now called Michelle Merrick. And she was in almost every single one of Martha Coolidge's early movies. So she was clearly one of her sort of like, you know, good luck charm actresses.
Yeah, Jordan is cute. She doesn't dress provocatively. She wears overalls. She's just really like one of the, I don't want to say one of the guys. She's just one of the students and treated as such. I love seeing that.
And I love how she's constantly doing smart things in the narrative without them pointing it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a roster of like her and an Asian character named Ick are the two people always with Chris
and Mitch. Yeah.
And Mitch. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting how the end of the movie is the four of them together.
Yep.
Not just Chris and Mitch, but this mm-hmm. whole group of characters. And there's a wonderful sort of organic, one person comes up with one idea, one mm-hmm. person comes up with another idea.
And then there are these little things that you miss unless, well, you know, I missed them a lot when I was a kid, but when I started to rewatch it, like in high school and college, you know, when Ick first meets Mitch, he says, "Hey, want a cherry?" and pulls out this giant, like fist-sized cherry out of his backpack and says, "I grow them myself." And it's just things like that, that their brilliance is just sort of spoken about and taken in stride. It's just so entertaining.
And I honestly think, I believe Allison Hannigan's Willow Rosenberg character from Buffy is absolutely based on Jordan. It's such a specific character type I never saw before. Mm-hmm. Really have not seen much since. Mm-hmm. The amount of respect that was given to a hyper-intelligent, slightly neurotic character who grows in confidence over time mm-hmm. is such a unique stereotype. I had a major crush on her when I first saw it.
As well you should. For a while I described myself as a Jordan from Real Genius meets a Fran from Strictly Ballroom. So, but that's my jam. As long as we're talking about the characters that we love from this movie, mm-hmm. we have to talk about the character we love to hate. Well, two of the characters that we love to hate. So Jerry Hathaway is just such a dick. He's played by William Atherton, who you'll also know as Walter Peck from Ghostbusters. And he just comes off the same as this like self-satisfied, smarmy jerk, very self-important, that you're kind of waiting to see him taken down a peg, but he's also very powerful. He's a formidable enemy that starts off as your friend, which is what's so fascinating about this movie. You know, he's a person who lifts Mitch out of the boredom of high school and takes him to this, you know, magical genius wonderland. He is Chris's, I guess, I don't want to say like thesis advisor, but kind of sort of, that's mm-hmm. the role that he plays. So he's everyone's sort of sub-mentor.
And he says early on, I made it a point to write this down, he goes, "We're different from most people. Better. And
definitely an elitist, for sure.
And that's part of what's interesting about him compared to most bad guys in college comedies, is that Chris is actually intimidated by him. And he doesn't ever let it show in a direct way. He sort of redirects with comedy.
Mm-hmm. He calls him Jerry, which Hathaway tolerates. Kent, who we'll talk about in a second, tries to call Hathaway Jerry. Jerry does not tolerate it.
He thinks of himself both above his students and above the military people.
Contractors that he's working with, yeah. He's embezzling their money into making his house nicer.
And he knows that they know, and he still doesn't care.
They even tell him fraud is a felony when they see all the people working on his house. And then he turns around and tells the contractors working on his house, get back to work. What is the line? It's get back to work.
Your laborers, go labor.
Go labor. That's what you get for not having an education.
But what I think
he's such a dick.
What I find so interesting, too, at the end is that lack of empathy, that sort of... what we were saying earlier about, you know, no compassion. Mm-hmm. Everyone else has compassion except for him.
Yep.
And what's so fascinating about the end of the movie is he is so smart, he figures out mm-hmm. that he's been duped before he's actually duped.
Yeah, when he's with the military people and they're trying to figure out where the laser went, what it destroyed, as opposed to it's supposed to destroy this, like, Kennedy...
Motorcade,
thank you, in the middle of the desert, and it goes haywire because the Pacific Tech kids have rigged it to destroy Hathaway's house instead. In the most brilliant way, it's destroyed by filling it with popcorn, which Hathaway hates for some reason. So it's just the perfect screw you to him. Anyway, so they're trying to figure out where it went, and Hathaway just pushes them aside and starts looking for it because he knows. He knows that he's done something bad, and he knows that he's getting the comeuppance.
And it's even before that, because he finds the microchips on the floor.
Uh-huh. Oh,
and then,
yeah. Talk
and then
about that.
His contractor partner comes out, "Is anything wrong?" All he had to say is, "This chip is not supposed to be here."
But his hubris won't let him.
And that's what I found so compelling in the end, is that it's his hubris that does him in, not any other, not his intelligence, it's his mm-hmm. hubris. Because when he then is leaving the plane, Chris and Mitch escape off the landing gear, and he turns around and he senses them.
He knows they're there. Yeah. But again, he doesn't tell anybody and he doesn't say anything. And I think a lot and I talk a lot about the lessons that I took away from these movies that I watched as a kid. Some of the lessons were not so great. Some of them were really good. And one of the lessons that I took away from Real Genius is you have to fix your mistakes. If you do something wrong, or even if you don't intend to, you still got to make it right. Because it's a moral imperative.
And that moves us on to Ken, who's the secondary villain.
Oh my God.
And there's one thing I really love is that Kent is by all extensive purposes, a very waspy, handsome, chiseled chin guy with huge glasses and braces.
The irony of Kent when you first meet him is that he immediately just like latches on to picking on Mitch. And he is dressed just as dorky as Mitch. He too looks like his mother dressed him, and he's got the Coke bottle bottom glasses. But he commits himself to what I think is the worst kind of nerd. The kind of nerd who believes in a pecking order. Who believes that if he can just find someone below him to kick constantly, that somehow elevates him.
He even starts with a monologue saying, everything goes from God to Jerry to me. And
Jerry and God disagree.
He is actually, like everybody else on Pacific Tech, he is a smart character. His punishment in the movie is not to be sort of destroyed in a way, but really just get him out of his head.
Mm-hmm.
And they invite him in on the prank at the very end of the movie. And he foolishly, well, they invite him to see the prank, but they never meant to hurt him.
They don't. And in fact, what's funny, so the other kids at Pacific Tech, our core group of friends, they drug Kent. And what's great about when they drug Kent, they pump gas into his room and another student walks by and sees what they're doing. And they're just like, hi. And the student doesn't say anything because everyone knows Kent is a dick. Whenever Kent does something that's dickish, you know, he's the only one who's laughing as loud as he is at it. Anyway, they drug him. They install something in his teeth that make it sound like a microphone. And they pretend to be God talking to him so that they can get info about where the weapon has gone. And then at the end, you know, near the end, when they hint that he should go to Hathaway's house to see what's up, what I loved, and I didn't really think about until just now, I mean, until we watched it last night, he's standing outside of Hathaway's house, and Kent says, okay, God, give me a sign and about whether or not I should walk into this house. Nothing happens, so he says, okay, well, I'm walking in. And at that moment, the Pacific Tech kids jump up and are like, don't go in, don't go in, a clear sign. Totally ignores it, walks in anyway. But he ends up fine. He doesn't end up hurt because really nobody in this movie ends up hurt because that's not like an accurate retribution for the crimes that any of them have committed.
Well, someone is hurt off camera at the very beginning of the movie when a government contractor or a government agent basically says, I'm going to not be part of this.
Yeah. And it's the one minority in the room, too. This one black guy stands up and he's like, I cannot do this. I cannot be a part of this machine. And he leaves. And then is it Craig T. Nelson?
It's Ed Lauder.
Okay. Basically says something indicating that we got to take care of this guy. Just go kill him, essentially. So they're set up very quickly as the true, true villains in this world. And you know what? I am here. I am here for the shade that this movie throws against the industrial military complex. I see that in Short Circuit, too. I know that's tangential, but I really love these 80s movies that take on the war machine and have the guts to criticize it the way they do.
And I think that was a common thing we had seen going back as far as E.T.
The trope
of the people standing up against the bureaucracy,
mm-hmm.
which even as a kid under 10 years old seeing this movie, is that I understood that cynicism very early on. Like, I picked it up. And the movie sort of respects the audience intelligence because when everyone's talking about science, even if you don't understand it, they give you that wonderful quality of being, it was very well researched. They had a lot of Caltech people as actual consultants and on the set.
That's awesome.
For both the social details and of course, the science. So everyone working on the project talked with a lot of actual scientists here. Apparently, William Atherton is still friends with a USC laser scientist
who he
befriended to, you know, get to know how it works because the actors had to believe in what they said.
Mm-hmm.
And what I love about movies about smart people is when they talk in a way that invites you in, even if you don't know what they're saying, you understand the intent behind what you're saying, and that makes you feel smart too. That makes you feel part of the situation too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a quality that even so young, I picked up on it immediately. And it's why you can rewatch the movie because of the depth and research. Like Laszlo Holyfield is actually based on two separate people.
What?
I mean, that exact person didn't live there, but yes, there was one person that was hiding away, living underneath the campus doing stuff, and
there was people living
within the system. There's lots of inside jokes to Caltech on the walls and little here and there.
That's so cool.
And roughly, I don't have proof of this, but apparently the idea of kids working on a laser project was something that actually happened once. Though the plot of the movie and the popcorn, obviously, no, they made that up.
The popcorn did not happen in real life. Slightly disappointing, but I get it. It was a lot of popcorn.
I have to say, watching the movie this time, I had a very emotional reaction to it.
You were taking a lot of notes.
And just looking at it from a writing point of view, the movie has no fat. It's constantly saying a lot of jokes. It's the writers of the movie, there are three of them, but the two core ones were Pat Proffitt, who ended up doing the Naked Gun and Hot Shots movies, and his partner, who was Neil Israel, also did Top Secret and Bachelor Party with him. And they both had a love for classic screwball comedy, where everyone's smart and talking really fast, like Bringing Up Baby, I think The Front Page, just all of those fast-talking, smart people movies, basically. And I think that they emulated that in a really beautiful way here, where there's so many throwaway lines that we were, when we were rewatching it, both of us just in the middle of stuff would just quote a line.
Yeah.
And everybody in the movie gets some sort of good line or beat. Almost everybody.
Yeah.
Like even a two-scene character like the Dean gets this amazing bit where he has like maybe four lines in a scene.
Oh yeah. Mitch is trying to get to this, you know, new student's welcome thing, this little social event. And, you know, he sort of stuffily says, you know, Mitch says, "You have any words of wisdom for me?" And he says, "Always, never forget to check your references."
And then he leaves and then he just says a line, goes, "I think the students like it when I can get down with them
to the level
verbally."
It's so great.
And it's such a specific language in the movie that's just, it's so smart.
Yeah.
It's so wonderful. And
it doesn't set him up to be a jerk or an idiot. It's just a character with fun quirks. And that's one of the many things I appreciate about this movie.
I also liked how, if you want a movie with 80s montages, this is the movie of 80s montages.
Can we talk about the montages and the music in this movie? Okay, so like Roth was saying, everyone gets a good line or two or several. And what I love about it, like I was saying earlier, is that the movie doesn't spoon feed them to you. You hear them. You pick up on them. There are no like musical cues to tell you like, oh, this is funny, or oh, there's slapstick going on. There's a couple of montage scenes set to the most exquisite 80s synth songs. Ralph told me last night that he has his soundtrack. I have wanted it for 30 something years. I'm so excited.
To be clear, people, there isn't an actual CD soundtrack. You had to piece it together from the songs on the soundtrack. Like,
oh, man.
So, no.
Let's make it happen, y'all. Let's make this happen.
Okay.
Someone start a petition.
La La Land Records. I know you guys. You can do this. I'm going to name drop. Come on, guys. Ford Thaxton, you can do this.
I'm sure.
Matt Verboys, do this. Everyone wants a soundtrack.
Yeah, 2020 is going to be the somethingth anniversary of this movie.
It should be the 35th, actually.
Yeah, let's get it done.
And it has a score, early score by Thomas Newman.
The score is great. It reminds me of the last scene, or one of the last scenes in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where Cameron finally realizes that he's going to be okay. My notes to it were, I love how the score has this Cameron's going to be okay bounce to it. It's such an 80s thing, but yeah, it warms my heart. And it communicates to you that this is intense, but you know, but take heart, because they're going to be all right.
I love the really fun comment I heard about Social Network, which is when David Fincher was talking to is Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor about doing the score, and he went, "I want a dark version of a Thomas Newman 1985 score." And he was specifically, it's clear he was referring to this. So that score had a lot of influence on a lot of other stuff, because Newman did like this, Man with the One Red Shoe, he did Lost Boys. It's really amazing how there was a lot of dumb teen soundtracks out there, but this one was actually very hip for the time, very cool, but also emotionally connected with the storytelling. And you know, this is why Thomas Newman has like 13 Oscar nominations.
That's so interesting. Not to go off on a tangent, but just a quick side note, when The Social Network came out, I did not see it. When it was available for streaming, one of my old sweet mates from Harvard texted me and said, "Have you seen The Social Network?" And I said no, and she was like, you need to see it. And I did, and I watched it, and then I immediately watched it again with the person I was with at the time, because there's something about the score that captures that like unsettled, unhappy, intense feeling that you get some nights there when you're studying, and it just feels like the sun's never going to come out again. There were good times at Harvard, but man, there were some intense ones too. So it's funny that you should say that, Ralph. Interesting.
And I think that both movies have that sort of intense, intelligent characters. There sort of aren't a flip side movies when you think about it.
Yeah, Social Network is the camera film negative of Real Genius in a way.
By the way, I do hold Real Genius that high. I mean, it is my favorite 80s teen comedy next to probably Ferris Bueller, I would say. Those are my two top crown movies.
You know, for a long time, Ferris was, and Ghostbusters I considered to be my very top, but looking back on it, well, let's raise the question of how do you rate your favorite movie? Is it just by love or by the influence it's had on your life? And like I said earlier, Real Genius has had an incredible amount of impact on my life. You know, it's easy for me to make a joke like, oh, I went to Harvard because of Real Genius. But looking back, it did instill these values of being smart and wanting to surround myself with smart people. And it was not a coincidence that when I did go to Harvard, I wore my bunny slippers everywhere for a while and was the only person who did so and was disappointed in that. But if I may, I do want to just have a quick PSA. This is kind of personal, and I will probably owe all of our listeners a $40 therapist copay by the end of it. But I just want to say, you know, as a young woman growing up, I loved school, and I loved writing, but somehow or other, through the people in my life, it was instilled in me that I was not good at math and science. And I don't... like, there are specific people that I could point to. What's funny is I can think of the people who did not have that effect. Like, my high school had a physics teacher who was a woman who was amazing. Everyone thought she was so cool. But I don't know. I don't know if it was just a social cue, that an unspoken cue that I picked up on, or very specific characters. But somehow or other, I was told, you're not good at that. Focus on what you're good at. What you're good at is writing. And I love writing. You know, I wrote a series of young adult books that I love and I'm very proud of. But, yo, encourage the women in your life to study math and science. And not just because of the idea of, oh, these are careers that you can be successful in. But try to capture that real genius enthusiasm for all the neat things that you can do with your brain's creativity. All from growing giant cherries to freezing the hallway to stopping the military industrial complex. It's so important. And inspire all kids that you know, all young people, to be excited about math and science and the cool, amazing, wonderful things that they can do to make this world better, because that really is a moral imperative.
I am completely with you there.
We have a lot to say about this movie, and everything that we have to say is positive, which I want it to be interesting, though. I don't want this to just be an episode where we gush about it and how much we love it. Don't worry, we have a lot of data. Roth, as always, is bringing the background information that will highlight my just sort of jumping around the room squealing about how much I love this movie.
I wanted to ask you one thing here.
Yes.
There's the bit where Laszlo comes at the end of, I think, the second montage in the movie, when Chris is finally getting on top of his horse again and studying again. Mm-hmm. And he just gives...
and dressing like Kent, which is not subtle. I thought that was funny. Oh, just real quick, I want to say, is Chris Knight the first character in pop culture to wear ironic t-shirts?
I don't think he is, but he's definitely the top of his game.
God, I love that.
Because his entrance is on his feet and another person's feet, and he's got these bright, colorful Skechers or something.
Yeah, Vans. Yeah, old school. And he's wearing the t-shirt that says, I heart atomic waste.
Hi there. His t-shirt actually says, I heart toxic waste. I was just so excited that I got it wrong.
And then he's wearing the little Martian headband
like
thing.
Googly things on his head. And when someone makes a comment about, like, are those things on your head? He says, because if I put them anywhere else, it chafes.
And he even admits, you know, it's his...
I don't want to be like all work, no play.
Actually, there's no work, no penis.
That's it. Thank
you. And then he goes, it's an infantile reaction to authority. Like, he gives three jokes in a row. One where he's telling the truth. One where he's messing with them. And
then finally, honest. And it's just... yeah, it's just so fantastically disarming. Yeah.
And what I sort of like...
it's disarming.
Oh, I see what you did.
Do you? Okay, let's go.
Oh, I got it. But when Laszlo comes to him and he says, hey, I got all the questions for every test Hathaway's ever done, it's the only moment in the movie that implies cheating. And we as an audience sort of jump over that. And I was fascinated by why I never thought about that as a big deal.
Is it because by that point Hathaway has been set up as evil, so it's not so much cheating because he's not like part of their moral system anymore.
Well, he also beforehand basically told Chris, the thing you earned, you're not going to get.
Ah, okay.
And that's why I think we forgive it, because Chris is, because Hathaway has now said, I am skewing the system. The house is going to win.
Yeah.
And so, so Chris's reaction to it is, okay, then I will fix the house. And I think the reason why we're okay with that is we know Chris has the knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It's not whether or not Chris needs to gain any knowledge. It's he needs to know how to game Hathaway.
And even if there's a question about whether or not this is a wrong or right thing to do, what I love is Chris's first of all, he's taken aback. He doesn't expect this. And the first thing he says is, gee, Laszlo, I didn't get you anything. As if it's a reciprocal system of appreciation.
And what I love the best is that in the same moment, Laszlo has this big armful of, it's like $1.6 million entries into the Frito-Lay contest where he's going to win like 32.6%. He has all the math worked out. It's based on a real thing.
Right. But doesn't one of the characters asks him, like, is that legal? And he says, I didn't make the rules. It's their game, you know? So again, it's not, they're not trying to cheat the system. They're playing by the rules. They're just smart at playing by them.
It's always been a movie that on the surface I thought was sort of ramshackle, because it's just going all over the place and you're in the world and it's so busy with just life. The movie's actually shot by Vilmos Zsigmond, Oscar-winning cinematographer, did Close Encounters, he did Deer Hunter. He's one of the greatest that's ever lived. You don't get him to shoot a teen comedy. He does this beautiful job of making the place feel sort of this colorful, idealized college. You want to go to this college.
I want to live in the real genius world, even with the evil military people there. It really is set up like the kind of place. Ralph and I have talked before about like what movies from your childhood have, you know, your dream home or the place that you'd want to live forever. I'd want to live in Real Genius. I totally would.
It has a 2.35:1 frame, that like really wide frame that epic movies have, which you don't usually do for teen movies. The frame is always filled with some detail. Coolidge is amazing with extras, because the extras don't all feel like they're doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone sort of feels like they're living in the space, like they're just hanging out, like in a Linkletter movie where people feel like, oh, they're just hanging out there. They're just, we're seeing people in their
native environment. Their native habitat. And the diversity of the cast is so great to see. Yes, Chris and Mitch are both Caucasian males. You know, Jordan's female. Ick is Asian. And even Kent has this little posse of it's him and another Anglo guy and a black male. And it's just so great to see people of color and women in this universe.
Now, I am Cuban-American.
I'm Mexican-American.
And this movie is the first time I had ever heard my name said out loud. There's a moment.
Sorry, I don't mean to laugh.
It's true.
You were so excited when we first like started dating and talking about. So, fun fact, the night Raphael and I met was at a friend's party, and we bonded over our love specifically of the early 90s, late 80s action movies, Die Hard and Terminator 2, which puts us in that generation of people who saw Real Genius a lot on HBO. And he told me this story about hearing his name said by Kent. At a certain point, he's just walking down the hallway and says,
hey, Raphael.
I thought it was hello, Raphael.
Or something like that.
It stands out in your mind.
It's just this wide shot at the end of the hallway. Mm-hmm. You barely hear it because it's about him walking to his room.
It is very subtle, yeah.
Because this was 5 years before Ninja Turtles movie was out.
Ooh.
And so this was like the first time anything resembling representation for me was even there.
Yeah.
When the only time you hear your own name is just in your personal life, you don't read it in books, you don't see it in comic books, you don't see it in movies. That is a wonderful spark of an emotional connection to, oh, I am.
You realize that you're talking to somebody who has spent entire relationships with people noticing how they refuse to say my name unless they have to. For the record, my name is Sara. It's Sarah, S-A-R-A-H. The Spanish pronunciation, though, that's what my family calls me. Yes, I know that Sara in Spanish does not have an H. There is a long story about my grandmother moving from Louisiana to South Texas, becoming Sara. Long story short, Raph, I feel what you mean about not having your name in pop culture. So I'm delighted that Real Genius is the first time that you heard it. And I got to admit, look, I like TMNT. I'm, you know, down with the Turtle Crew. But I'm glad that the first time you heard it was Real Genius, because this is just such a remarkable movie.
that definition of the cult movie that people like to refer to, because it was a failure at the time, and financially. It quickly turned around and got, I think, pretty beloved cult to it. Mm-hmm. It's just not a very loud one. Those that love it, I feel, love it with an incredible passion.
And they should. That's, yeah. God, I love this movie.
Mm-hmm. In fact, when was the first time you saw it?
That is hard to say. It might have just been on in the background. Now, I admit, this is going to probably shock no one. I was a super weird kid growing up. I was this very strange child who believed that what was going on TV or on the movie screen was actually real. So it was hard for me to watch, as much as I love action movies now, it was hard to watch stuff where things exploded or stuff was in space. I don't know. Yeah, I'm definitely in the minority about that. So it might have been on, and I remember it being on and feeling a little hesitant to watch it because there was some element. Maybe I thought the lasers were a little bit scary. But then when I started hearing the jokes and I started seeing just how enigmatic Chris Knight was, I was immediately drawn in. We'll talk in this podcast about movies that have jokes. And, you know, as a kid, you're trying to figure out the world of adults and you see these people being funny and you think, oh, this is what jokes is. This is how funny is. And Real Genius is one of those movies from my childhood where the jokes do stand up, and I'm glad that I learned that I was exposed to such great comic timing and such cleverness at an early age, because it really does hold up over time. But yeah, I can't remember the first time I saw this movie. I just remember it being on in the background and then absorbing it piece by piece and wanting to see more of it. As with many movies of my youth, I don't super remember the very beginning of this, either because we forgot to tape it when it came on HBO, or because I was bored by it. When I was 4 years old, I was the only person in my household who could operate the VCR. So if something was going to be fast forward, I was the person making that decision. So yeah, I don't remember the military stuff so much, probably because it either scared me or we didn't record it. Yet my love for it is much even larger than the sum of its whole pieces, parts, stuff.
I don't know. I know I didn't see it in the theaters.
Neither did I, for sure.
I don't know if I saw it on VHS first, but I do remember it was coming on HBO and it was premiering. I think we got cable right around August, September 86. So that was a big deal.
How old were you then?
Well, I wasn't 10 yet, so.
Oh. I think we got cable when I was like 7 or 8, maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe, something
yeah,
like that.
It was, you know, right in the same era there.
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember that they would have that one channel. Yeah, this was the first time we got cable, because we got like a VCR 3 years before. And for anyone who didn't grow up with the ability to watch media when you want to, a VCR was like the most amazing thing.
Oh, life-changing.
And nothing nowadays compares to that moment when you could, the TV dictates it, or you had to go see it in the theaters, to being able to go back to something.
Yeah, like, I don't want to sound like an old fart now, but some cultural impacts that Ralph and I grew up with that, you know, people younger than us have not experienced is that idea of, A, if it comes on TV and you do not tape it, you have missed it forever. There is no way you can find it. And B, if someone takes the tape out of the VCR, if they tape over it, if they have it, oh my God, set to the wrong channel.
Sorry.
You're screwed. You're screwed. You're totally screwed. There's no streaming. There's no YouTube. You can't find it. It's gone in the ether. So yeah, there was a lot of pressure to tape stuff.
And they had this channel that would just slowly list. It was like 41 or something. And it would just slowly list all of the things that are playing on today.
Oh, dang. So you just sit and watch it and wait.
And it was like a TV guide channel.
Yeah.
But I remember that they would have in the top right-hand corner, they would have little trailers for things. And I saw the trailer for Real Genius playing. It was on a loop, so it was like several other trailers than the trailer for Real Genius. I think I was at like a family gathering and I had a TV playing, and I was just watching that channel for the trailer, and I think I saw the trailer 3 or 4 times in a row waiting to see it. It was going to play tonight at like, you know, at 8 Pacific, 7 Central. The folks are going, well, you want to go home and watch something, right? And then my Aunt Janet was like, oh, what does he want to watch? And then I was like, oh, I'm going to see Real Genius. And she had seen me watching commercials. No, I'm not going to watch that with you. Because I had bored
Why?
Them. Well, because I had been playing the trailer over and over and over and over and driving them so nuts.
Oh, my God.
HBO made really good trailers, actually.
They really, I mean, I watched The Golden Child a lot as a kid. Not an appropriate movie for children. But the trailer was really compelling. It was funny. Eddie Murphy makes jokes.
And there were like these little 30-second sort of bap, bap, bap. Because if you look at the real trailers for the movies, not as good.
No, because back then, trailers were, there were more like synopses. Like, there's a voiceover sort of telling you in a catchy way, you know, what's going on and what's happening, and he's here to save the day. But it wasn't punchy. It wasn't as exciting. It was much, much slower, much more of like a book jacket description than a modern day trailer.
I think it really wasn't until like Batman in 89 where we had that teaser trailer that made everyone lose their minds.
That was an epic marketing campaign. Yeah. Story for a future podcast.
And that's what I would do is I would actually tape, make certain I taped in between the movies on my VCR for HBO so I could have those trailers for stuff.
Yeah, and if you want to see some, let me tell you, YouTube is full of them. We tried to find this specific Real Genius trailer last night on YouTube. We couldn't find it, but we did find a lot of other stuff that, that was an interesting walk down memory lane.
And I think what's very interesting revisiting the movie now is that the movie really is about Mitch and Chris. And Mitch is our surrogate. Mm-hmm. And Mitch is, the actor who plays him, ended up popping up in other stuff like Apollo 13 as one of the, on one of the guys, you know, in the room. But he has this, he's both not as charismatic as young, early, mid-20s Val Kilmer, who would be. Yeah. But he's incredibly empathetic. And he pulls off sort of awkwardness without it coming off as off-putting.
Yeah, like, there are points where you look at these two and you're like, why is Chris Knight even hanging out with this kid? Like, why is he being nice to him? And it might be a little bit of enlightened self-interest. Well, the first time they meet, Chris tells him, I used to be you, and I decided I was missing me, so I asked that they let me room with me. Which is how Mitch ends up to be his roommate. So you do kind of wonder, like, why is this super cool dude hanging out with this dork? And maybe it's because he sees himself in him, but also just because he's just a nice person who wants to, be there for this kid who's in over his head.
I think he's being on the surface honest because he never really lies about his intention and things.
This is true.
And it's not just Chris giving Mitch the tools to survive, meaning like what I would have wanted when I, you know, first came to Pacific Tech. But I think it's also a thing where Mitch teaches him responsibility again. They both go through arcs that they influence the other person on.
I guess so. I was thinking specifically of the scene where Mitch is working on the laser and Chris walks in a chef's hat holding something and asks Mitch to taste it. And Mitch says, where did you get this? And he says, I don't know. I found it in the lab. And Mitch starts gagging. He's like, it's just yogurt. Relax. And then they do that fantastic job about Mitch is frustrated. And so Chris says, oh, let's take a step back. No, wait, I was wrong. Let's take a step forward. No, let's take a step back. And now forward. And now we're cha-cha-ing. Oh my God. But yes. And then Mitch is like, can you just be serious for a second? And Chris is like, all right, yes, let's solve this problem. So that's my long-winded way of saying I agree with you.
And then when Chris gets disillusioned, Mitch tells him back the same lesson that Chris told him.
I love that scene. It's one of the few scenes where the characters are outside, oddly enough. They're outside. They're sitting under the stars. Chris is just looking up at the sky. Hathaway has just told him, you're not going to graduate and you're not going to get the job that I'd set up for you. And so Mitch comes out and Mitch is kind of joking around like, oh, you can't just leave school. You owe me $20. And Chris has that fantastic line about, I feel like Socrates when he said, I drank what? But Mitch does pull him out of his funk and tells him, like, you know, this isn't over. You can't just walk away from this. We have to get even, in a good way.
Then the second time Chris has to come out of his funk, it's Laszlo, the person that knows more than anybody else the moral imperative of stopping the situation.
That's right. When they realize that the laser they've been working on is being used as a weapon, and Laszlo gets them to pull it together.
Everyone has really the same internal dilemma, and everybody is linked emotionally with that same problem, because Kent is culpable as well. He was the one who built the targeting mirror, for instance. In a sense, they're trying to get revenge for him as well.
Yeah.
That's, again, it's what I love is that inclusive quality to the movie.
They have a community. They are truly friends, and you don't see that a lot. Seeing examples of friendship in movies, there's so much shorthand. Like, people do nice things for each other. There's that concept of, oh, you're there, you know, you're always there when I need you. These kids really are there for each other when they need each other, whether they realize it or not. It's so strange to think of this movie as of Uber Nerds as also like one of the best examples of what true friendship is.
Because then if you compare this to, say, Big Bang Theory, that is a much more toxic relationship, in my opinion, for actual intellectual characters. And
we could say a lot about Big Bang Theory. Full disclosure, neither of us like the show. I have friends who love it very, very much, and that's fine. You know, it makes them laugh. That's fine. I don't I don't like it because I don't want to spend time with people who's, you know, 30 minutes just tearing each other down. I don't find that kind of humor funny.
And it's not just that show. I feel like in general, the idea of a companionship often has a very competitive, toxic quality to it.
Yeah.
Over the last, it's a trend over the last 15 years of comedy, I feel.
And then, I mean, if you want to make a really big grandiose statement, you could say that we see that kind of thing in social media all the time. You know, we're happy for each other. Aren't we really? One of the things that I love about Jordan's character is, again, spoiler ahead, she gets together with Mitch. Mitch isn't treated like the protagonist in some other like nerdy teen comedies. He doesn't get this hot girl as a prize. He gets together with somebody who is just as awesome and interesting as he is, and that's Jordan. And it doesn't feel, in a lot of these movies, I feel like people settle for each other. I look forward to going on a rant about Pretty in Pink and how Molly Ringwald's character is better than every dude in that movie. And whoever she gets with, she is settling on some level. And I don't, Jordan and Mitch are not settling for each other. They're both fantastic and they're both prizes. And, but not to be won. They're just, their reward is that they're awesome people and they get to be together as awesome people. God, I love that.
Their connection is always over something one of them is doing. Mm-hmm. Like, they first meet because she has her little bobsled.
She creates this little toboggan that goes down the iced over hallway. And then she's upset because it should have gone much further, much faster. But she doesn't, like, beat herself up about it. It's just, it's more like, okay, I have to go back and do it again. Okay, what was your name? So,
and
yeah.
Then, and then the next time she's got her own...
dog.
And next time it's because she has her own scuba gear and he's trying to help her with the scuba gear. It's mm-hmm. always, there's a context of both of them sharing something they have that they're doing with the other person. Oh, she has a new invention she's done.
Yeah, she's never there just to be seen or to look for a person. It's, I've got this thing. I'm doing this thing. Do you want to do this thing with me? It's so cool. I love that.
Great little detail, too. There's a bit where they all have burgers at the end of Act 2.
Oh, yeah.
And then...
Just before they realize that the laser they've created is a deadly machine, they're at this total dive bar that they've accidentally blown a hole through the sign. So they're like, eh, let's just get burgers here. And as people are trying to kill one another over the pool table with pool cues, the students are just sitting in the corner and the dudes are having burgers.
Well, everybody's got a beer except for Mitch because he's 15.
Yeah.
And then he and her are just sharing a milkshake.
They're sharing a milkshake. There's two straws in it. It's so adorable.
And I love that type of detail without saying anything. I mean, the movie is constantly, everything is informed in this universe in terms of even her room. It's an industrial room. She is like put no personal sort of accoutrements. It's just got a lot of gear. She's got a loft thing. She's literally an engineer, which is funny because it reminds me of an actual engineer I knew that went to JPL, and it was that thing where she just had that mind where I want to build this, I want to build that, I want to build that. And that's what she is. She's a builder. She dresses pretty much like a mechanic most of the time.
And when Mitch comes over to Jordan's room to tell her, you know, he wants to be with her, she's sanding the floor?
Yeah, she's buffing
the
floor.
I love it. I love it. But she's not perfect, and nobody in this movie is perfect. When she meets Mitch, she tells him that, you know, she used to have this roommate, but so Jordan never sleeps, but she used to have this roommate, and it drove her crazy, and then the roommate, like, had to be taken away in an ambulance, and Jordan's sure that it wasn't her, it was probably just Pacific Tech, but she never sleeps. So it's clear that she's not, she is,
Well, she follows him into the bathroom, and
yes,
then...
Yes, has no idea why Mitch can't pee when she's standing there. There's this line from a Dave Sedaris story where he just says, I tend to exhaust people. And Jordan clearly exhausts people, but not everyone. You know, she finds her crew, and that's Mitch. And I think that's so cool.
I was thinking about why the Tears for Fears song is at the end of the movie, and I like
everybody wants to rule the world. Okay, I know we've talked a lot, but that scene where kids are running through popcorn that has just exploded out of Jerry Hathaway's house, and they're just so joyful, and Everybody Wants to Rule the World is playing. It's just that perfect, perfect, amazing blend of happiness and youth with the stresses of adulthood. So one of my favorite books is this book called The Savage Girl by Alex Shakar, and there's this concept in it of to make a really effective marketing campaign, you have to take two things that are totally opposite and pair them together. Paradescences, he calls them. And one of the examples in the book is like a coffee advertisement. It's both soothing and invigorating. And that's what I love about that last scene in the movie where you're blending just like these kids having fun with this song that is, you know, about the stresses of being an adult and wanting to rule the world.
reminds me of like the Patton Oswalt comment, which is, you know, be kind. I think the movie actually is saying, be careful. There's a lot of people out there that want to use you, mm-hmm. and you need to do something kind.
And that's even done, God almighty. So when I was a kid, I didn't really appreciate the opening credits to this movie, where there are these old school, like Greek, they start out very old and then they move to more modern drawings of weapons and things that are designed to kill people over this sort of like a bouncy, smooth, old school jazzy song about how you took advantage of me.
Because, yeah, what teen movie begins with that? And then and then a bunch of, you know...
Truly terrifying men around desks talking about bombs. Mm.
It's that situation where I think it was this confluence of just like a lot of really talented people who brought their A-game to it and got talented actors as opposed to stars at the time.
I still think, as much as I like Top Secret, like I said earlier, this is Val Kilmer's best performance. The gentleman who plays Laszlo Hollyfeld.
Oh, Jonathan Gryce.
Yes.
You know him as Uncle Rico.
From Napoleon Dynamite, mm-hmm. right. He was fun in that, but this is just... I can't think of anyone in this movie who has played a better role elsewhere. Even William Atherton, as fun as he was in Ghostbusters, he's just so nuanced in this, and he's just he just feels like such a real and terrifying character. There are tons of more things I could think of to say about this movie, but I feel like we've... The only other thing that I would say, it sort of goes back to the pecking order of... the thing about the nerd pecking order, as it's displayed in this movie, I don't know, It's hard, and I don't know if it's fair to compare a movie like Real Genius to something like Revenge of the Nerds, because it's just, that's such a broad comedy, and the people in it are just, you know, they're playing archetypes, and there's this social caste system that they want to break into and then conquer. And the thing about the caste system in Real Genius is that the kids just try hard not to have one. I'm thinking specifically about the scene. So there's a point where Mitch gets really upset and calls his parents and just freaks out and says he wants to come home. Anyone of us who spent time away from home, whether it was at like summer camp or college or just anywhere, there's a pretty big chance that at some point one of us just freaked out and wanted to go home. So it hits, no pun intended, it hits home for me, and I'm sure for a lot of people. And Kent's reaction is to tape this conversation and then play it over the audio speaker. That is the one scene in this movie that I still find hard to watch because it's so mean. And yeah, some people in the room, when he plays it, are sort of snickering and pointing at Mitch. Kent is the only one who's laughing his ass off because he's the only one who wants this social pecking order because he wants to be at the top. And I just love how the rest of them are like, you know, I mean, they're kids. Yeah, they're going to laugh at mean things sometimes. We all do, sadly, but I'm not going to play that game.
Well, there's characters. It's part of Coolidge's genius is that there's clearly characters in the background going to each other, like going, that's not funny. That's not funny at all.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, it feels, it's so powerful because it feels real as opposed to that sort of fake teen movie type of bullying. It's you have a lot of sympathy for Mitch and you don't want him to be hurt.
And even when, you know, Chris and Mitch talk about how something is a moral imperative and how they have to get back at someone, humiliation is rarely the MO. I mean, there is a scene where they take apart Kent's car and rebuild it in his room and it's like snoring and bouncing and he's got to deal with it. But it's not so much to embarrass him. It's more just to create a huge hassle for him.
So, as it's sounding, this is a movie we have the fullest recommendation. If we had some sort of scale of watching, this would be go out and see it. It has value on so many levels. It's currently available streaming to rent. There is a limited edition Blu-ray with the commentary by Martha Coolidge.
Do you have that?
I don't have it. I've been looking for it.
Dang, we got to get that. Someone send it to us.
And
we'll pay you back.
So there are ways of seeing the movie that aren't too hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's an absolute watch for anyone that even vaguely loves the genre, and even anybody who...
When you say the genre, can you be more specific? Because I think this movie is in a couple of different genres.
It is. It was a rare butterfly at the time. I think mm-hmm. there's a lot more stuff like it now.
Mm-hmm.
But it is in that it's part dramedy. Part a teen comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's part a...
nerd comedy.
Nerd comedy.
Very big in the 80s.
It's part a thriller.
That's true.
And it's sort of is all of these things at once.
A sexual coming of age story.
It's such a delicate balancing act where none of these elements feel out of place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the best movies are the ones where you don't really want to leave the universe.
Yeah.
And it's a world you really don't want to leave because, mm-hmm. like the best movies are, it has sort of like, even characters like Mitch's parents feel like real people. Even just sort of...
Yeah, like when they first meet Dr. Hathaway and they're so impressed that he's here, this big TV star. Oh my gosh, and he's here to give Mitch this great news. And Mitch's mother says, I have to ask you, is that your real hair? And he's such a dick. He's such a dick in like the most like sort of subtle, not even subtle, shady ways where he just says, can you tell me, is there any chance that Mitch is adopted? And she's like, why no? And he just goes, it's amazing. And she's like, isn't it? Totally oblivious that he's thrown shade at her.
I love this one beat where it's in the middle of the second montage, where a guy goes nuts. He breaks.
Oh, yeah. During the study session for finals.
And
he just stands up, starts screaming, runs out.
And everybody else doesn't really react.
No. It's just a thing that happens.
And then Ick gets up. Another guy almost gets up, but sits back down as Ick gets over and just takes over his spot.
Yeah.
And it's unstated. And it's that type of people are going to pop. And yeah. You just let it be and you don't get it in its way.
Yeah.
The movie constantly is having little details about smart people. Like, mm-hmm. like with Chris in general, Chris has all of this great physical behavior. He's a fidgeter. He always likes to do something at the same time he's doing something else. He'll be mm-hmm. flipping a coin over in his fingers. Mm-hmm. He'll be playing with a toy.
He's hot, but he's never shown working out. He's just always doing either like working or studying or doing goofy stuff.
He knows he's using a comical self-defense mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And in the montage of him studying, he sees a hot girl. He looks at her and
he like bites his fist and then goes back to studying.
And while sort of like fake sobbing to himself, he can't go.
He just has to focus on his work. Yeah.
And when everything becomes serious for him, the movie has spent so much time making you like the people mm-hmm. so that when you see his illusion about what he's been doing cracks and he says, you're easy to trick.
You're easy to trick, Mitch. I'm a cynic. Like, he should have seen it coming.
And the movie takes these characters' emotions seriously, even though we're not in their dark space that mm-hmm. much of the narrative.
Yeah. I cannot recommend this movie highly enough. I recommend it if you love 80s comedies. I recommend it if you like nerd movies. I recommend it if you want to see a movie where people form a community and they solve big problems through collaboration more than they do through competition. I think that's just such an important lesson for right now.
And this isn't about nostalgia. This is the type of movies that should be made.
Yeah.
Period.
Yep. This is the, what is that quote, be the change you want to see in the world. These are the nerds I want to see and be in the world. And that, over and over again, was What the Kids Were Watching.
What the Kids Were Watching has been produced and hosted by Sada Ruiz and Rafael Ruiz. Theme music provided by Pete Seibert. For more information on our podcast and to read the companion blog, well, really more of a cartoon sidekick, you can go to whatthekidswerewatching.com. You can also find us on social media. Look for What the Kids Were Watching on Facebook, What the Kids Were Watching on Instagram, and What the Kids Were on Twitter. What the Kids Were Watching, copyright 2019 and 2020, RAR Works, LLC.